The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. Got a nice toasty Friday afternoon as we record this in Colorado. The day was made even toastier by Jim's insistence that we move about 14 tons of waste material out of the basement of our office into his dump trailer. But luckily that job is now done, so hopefully that won't come around again anytime soon. Just a little insight as to the exciting things that we sometimes do at the office here. I will point out that somehow Jake, who was here this week, escaped back to Chicago safely, although I think it took him a while. I heard his flight got canceled, so he was still traveling as of today, according to Joe.
No kidding. I didn't hear that. Seriously?
Yeah, that's why he's bringing it up. Apparently his flight last night out of Denver that was supposed to go be direct to Chicago was delayed and then got canceled. There was nothing else that night, so this morning they put him on a flight to North Carolina to connect then to Chicago. So,
oh, that's straightforward. That makes sense. So, yeah, let's fly to...
So he had his own kind of misery while we were moving.
Yeah, I'm sure he'd rather be at the office and helping us clean out the basement rather than they flew him to North Carolina and then Chicago? That makes no sense.
Yeah.
If I was him, I would have said, screw it. I would have come back here for a couple more days.
So.
Yeah, I was wondering because they had pretty hard thunderstorms out at the airport.
Yeah, it's flying in and out of Denver in the summer in the afternoon and evening is a roll of the dice.
Not highly recommended at all.
If you want a little insight from locals, we all try to avoid that time period whenever possible.
On my return flight from Ohio, August 7th, I think I'm flying back. My sister's birthday, as a matter of fact. It lands at 4:30, and I couldn't avoid it. I was trying to get a different flight.
That'll be a fun. Just think of it as a visit to the amusement park.
Oh, well, I know the landing will be bumpy. Anybody who's ever flown into Denver knows it's always bumpy. And then in the summertime with our thunderstorms, it gets bumpy. They should have built the airport in Berthoud because it never freaking rains there. But they built it out on the Eastern Plains. When you land, folks, it looks like you're in Kansas. You don't even see the mountains. And the Eastern Plains get afternoon storms. Why do the plains always get, I don't know, something about the plains. But they get nailed constantly.
Yep.
Okay. Anyways, I didn't know Jake had to go through all that. Poor Jake.
Yep.
Wonder if he'll come back next year.
Well, he might come back at a different time of the year, maybe.
Yeah, he'll probably want to try to do it. We should do it in the fall.
Yeah, flying in and out of Denver in the fall is beautiful.
Yeah. So, and Paul wants, not Paul, Greg wants to come next year. So, Greg and Jake, we'll do it in the fall next year, September, October, somewhere around there, and not in the summer when you have to deal with what you guys were dealing with. All righty. Well, folks, this is the EDU show. The Q&A show of the Retirement and IRA Show. My name is Jim Salnier, and the other cohort that I've been chatting with is Chris Stein. Longtime listeners will know who we are. New listeners, well, keep listening and you figure out exactly who we are. Chris tends to be the wordy one, never shuts up, goes down these big-ass rabbit holes. Me, I'm very pithy, to the point, very academic-sounding. But you'll figure all that out as time goes on.
Mm-hmm. One of us has an accent and the other does not.
True. One grew up in Wyoming, the other grew up on the East Coast. Okay, so we're going to do something a little different.
Uh-oh.
Well, no, not uh-oh worthy different.
Okay.
Just we got no way near through all the annuity questions, and I still encourage people to send them. So I probably for the rest of this year we'll do two Social Security questions and an annuity question before the new question of the week and then an old question. That's all. That's the only thing that's new.
Okay.
Not bad.
Yeah, not earth-shattering.
No. That's what I said. Don't get nervous.
But whenever you say that, I mean, it does make me nervous.
Well, yes, sometimes
long-time listeners will know why.
Sometimes I get these brilliant ideas that, in hindsight, might not have been as brilliant as they were when they first popped into my head. Excuse me, folks. Sorry about that. I'm still not over that cold I got.
You're going to have that cough lingering for weeks. I'm still having it a little bit.
You think I have whatever the hell it is you have?
Sure sounds like it.
Well, that person from, you said your daughter got it from someone in Italy, right?
Well, on the flight, probably.
I caught this from you and not from someone in Ohio.
Over the electronics of Zoom? That's the only interaction we had. We were never together.
I didn't see you post being infected and before I left for Ohio to drop off stuff at the apartment.
We were never physically together.
Hmm.
So you can't blame me, but it's traveling anymore. Every time I get on a plane, it seems I catch something.
Yeah, I'm not looking forward to flying in the fall and winter. Summer, people are generally healthier.
Better.
But yeah, when you're flying in you always come back feeling ill. All right. Anyways, enough of that, folks. We're going to get to two Social Security. One question, Chris, is more calm down, breathe deep type comment he makes.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is a more traditional question.
Okay.
Would you like the calm down, breathe deep or the more traditional question first?
Well, let's start traditional question first.
All righty. See if they give a hint. Yes, they do.
Hmm.
Huh? Hmm. She doesn't give the answer, and I have no freaking idea. Here is our state clue. We're going to have to Google this. I'll Google, you guess.
Okay.
We are located in the same state as the Boston Mountains. As someone who grew up in Massachusetts,
like a trick question.
Yeah, I know. I don't think it's Massachusetts. I'm going to have to Google this.
There any part of Massachusetts that's considered mountains?
Yeah, we have the Berkshires. We would call them foothills, but Massachusetts calls them mountains.
New Hampshire.
Google that. Boston? Mountain.
Yeah, I've never heard of that.
Arkansas.
Interesting. I was way off.
Yes. According to Google, we could leave now, fly there in an hour and 55 minutes, and land in Fayetteville.
Hmm.
The Boston Mountains is a level 3 ecoregion designed by the Environmental Protection Agency in the U.S., state of Arkansas and Oklahoma.
Hmm.
They made the mountain?
Well, they probably just designated it an eco-protected area or something.
Ah. Okay, but anyways, Arkansas and a little bit of Oklahoma.
Hmm.
So I'm not sure if she's from Arkansas or Oklahoma. She could be from either place.
True. You learn something new every day.
You do.
I didn't know they existed. And I had no idea they were in that area of the country. So.
Okay. Oh, she sent me another email. I forgot to tell you the answer to my state clue. Oh. I'm in Arkansas.
There you go. Okay.
I should have kept reading.
Yeah.
All righty. Hi, I love your show and all the great info. It has been a great learning resource for me and my husband as we are nearing retirement. My question is regarding HSA contributions and the 6-month look back for Medicare. My husband will turn 70 November 13th, 2025. So not too much further from now, as we record this, it's July 11th. He is planning on retiring on December 31st of 2025. We would like to backdate his Social Security application so he will receive his first Social Security check in 2026 for tax purposes. We can push the application date out a couple of months if necessary. He made his last HSA contribution on June 5th and has contributed a total of $2,715 for 2015. We have now stopped further contributions. I realize that we have now contributed just over half of the $5,300 which he is eligible to contribute. So my question is the following. Is the six-month look-back for Medicare Part A based on when my husband files his Social Security application, or the date that he is eligible for his Social Security benefit, which is November 13th? You might have to explain what she's getting at with this look-back. Some people might not understand, Chris.
Right.
We are trying to avoid any penalty for excess HSA contributions, and I'm unclear on what date is used for the six-month look-back. If it's based on the date of his application, we could delay his Social Security even into 2026 to be safe and give him more months of eligibility for his HSA in 2025. However, if it is based on his actual benefit eligibility date of November 13th, then it seems that we will need to withdraw excess HSA contributions. Thanks so much for all you do for the retirement community. She gives her real name. We will call her Georgette. Can you help out Georgette and help people who don't understand why she's so concerned about this look back?
Yeah, I'll have to explain a few things before I address her question, just so people are on board with what's going on here. First of all, when she talks about backdating her application, what she's referring to there is a technique where they're waiting until after the typical age when you would absolutely want to turn on your Social Security, 70, because you're receiving no further delayed retirement credits after age 70. But they are waiting to file so that when they receive their first check, it will actually be in 2026 instead of 2025. Now, some of you might be thinking, well, by doing that, though, she's giving up money because they're waiting past 70. But that's not true, because you are allowed to backdate your application up to 6 months or back to your full retirement age, whichever is less. In this case, they're looking at waiting until December or later in order to file, but making their application effective as of November, so they're not giving up any payments. Social Security does this for people who, not necessarily you want a strategy like this, trying to push their Social Security benefit into the next year, but rather it's really meant for people who forgot to file or had some problems filing and it went past when they really wanted to file, so they'll allow you to backdate it back to, it's called retroactive filing, up to 6 months for this. Now, some people use this as a strategy, which is kind of what they're doing here. The other part to realize is you're only allowed to make an HSA contribution if two things are true. One, you're on a qualified high deductible health plan. That's the number one thing. And secondly, you're not enrolled in Medicare. Any months that you're enrolled in Medicare are months you're ineligible for an HSA contribution. So in a year where you were partly eligible and then maybe for the other part of the year you were on Medicare, you have a prorated amount in your cap for your contribution limit for HSA that year. And that's what they're worried about here is in 2025, if they file, not only are they looking at filing retroactively back to November, there's also a weird feature when you sign up for Medicare for the first time. If you're past 65, they actually forcibly enroll you in Medicare up to 6 months prior to when you contact them. It's intended to prevent gaps in coverage for the same reason there's the six-month retroactive filing for Social Security benefits. It's really meant to cover up mistakes or delays or a glitch that went wrong, so that you can, you know, effectively, again, backdate your application. But this is mandatory and forced upon you. The unique thing about that rule is it goes back, and this is part of her question. She's wondering, well, is that 6 months back from when I contact them to file, or is it 6 months back from when I actually make the benefits effective for them November of 2025? Is it then 6 months prior to that, right, pushing their eligibility cutoff back to May or so? Well, strangely enough, it is not when you turn on the benefit. It's not the effective date of the benefit. It's when you contact them. So when you, if you were to contact them, say, in December, they're going to make your benefits for Social Security start in November, as you asked, but they're going to retroactively enroll you in Medicare Part A back to June. So they might want to push it a little bit, because right now they've already shut off their contributions. And as long as they were eligible for more than half of the year, they won't have violated the contribution limits. So I would contact them to file maybe a little later in February or March. So when they backdate your Medicare application, it doesn't violate, it doesn't extend back more than half of the way into 2025, and then you'll be totally fine. They will then send you a lump sum catch-up check or deposit, which will be the lump sum amount for November, December, January, you know, all the way up to where it's real time now. And then you'll continue on with your age 70 benefit thereafter. But they'll make you whole with the 6 month retroactive filing. You won't necessarily be retroactively filing a full 6 months. If you were doing this in January, you're only going back 2 months, right? December to November. But you could do it up to six. But because of this HSA eligibility issue and the fact that you've already contributed about half, I would intentionally maybe wait until you file and make sure you don't contact them. If you contact them, they actually make it 6 months from the contact date. So you don't want to open a case. You don't want to set an appointment, because when you set the appointment, that's contacting them with the intention of filing, even if the appointment isn't a month or two later. We've run into somebody recently that's been emailing me that ran into this exact issue. He contacted them, but it took like 2 months before they could get him scheduled for a face-to-face meeting. Well, they retroactively enrolled him in Medicare 6 months prior to the date he called them initially. Wasn't even the date he had the appointment to turn on his benefits. Sorry, a little frog in my throat there. So that can be problematic. Now, it's not the end of the world if you turns up that you've contributed more than you should have. You can do an excess, you know, you can have to do a return of excess contribution, but kind of a pain and some paperwork. You got to work with your HSA custodian and stuff like that. So sounds like they said it's fine for them to wait a little bit to file. That's exactly probably what I would do in their case, is wait until February, March. And then when they backdate it 6 months, it won't be back, won't violate the 2025 pro rata HSA contribution calculation. And then they should probably be fine. So interesting one, something that for those of you contributing to HSAs well beyond age 65, because you're maybe on an employer plan, something you have to worry about, something you have to be concerned with. Again, it's not the end of the world to fix it if you violate this rule, but probably better to proactively avoid it instead. And if in doubt, cut off your HSA contributions a little earlier than what you intended, if you're worried about getting too close. Because getting an extra $1,000 or two into your HSA is not, you know, in the grand scheme of things, going to move the needle one way or the other very much. It's just going to, if you push a little too far and you over contribute 1 year, you're going to have kind of a paperwork, I won't call it a nightmare, paperwork annoyance, a time consuming annoyance and a distraction from enjoyable things you'd probably prefer to be doing. So I usually encourage people to cut it off a little early. Maybe just don't make any more HSA contributions in the year that you're retiring and filing for Social Security, so you don't have to worry about the pro rata at all. That's the safest way to do it. But if you want to push it right to the limit, just make sure you understand how the calculation works and you understand this 6-month retroactive enrollment in Medicare that happens when you file for Social Security or Medicare after age 65. That's the case where it occurs. So hopefully that helps him out a little bit.
Okay. Hey, it got me wondering on this 6-month retro.
Yeah.
And I thought I read an article on this once. If somebody incurs expenses that would have been covered by Medicare during that 6 month, I believe you can get reimbursed.
You should be able to, because you are, once it's in effect, it is actually in effect 6 months prior. So it's... even though you weren't having coverage when the event happened, you retroactively then had coverage. And yes, they should, what you would do, I believe the remedy for this is to contact the provider and say, please rerun this under Medicare now that I've enrolled and get payment from them and give me my money back. I don't think Medicare pays you.
Mm, okay.
So you would have to essentially, you're going to get a refund from the doctor's office or the medical facility, and they're going to then rerun your claim under an insurance you now have that you didn't when you paid them.
If anybody has had that happen to them during that 6-month period, you incurred some expenses. I'm just curious on how you got reimbursed. Did you do as Chris said, have the provider reissue the bill to Medicare? I'd be surprised they would do that, Chris, because they'd probably get less money. I'm just curious, because you often read about this retroactive and how it impacts HSA contributions because you are considered enrolled in Medicare. And I once read an article where they actually dove into that and said, hey, you can get coverage for expenses you incur during that 6-month period because they consider you enrolled. But I cannot remember in the article how you go about doing that. Anyways.
Yeah, I don't think Medicare is going to pay you because then they would be paying you rates that they haven't contracted for. They'd be, you know, we cost Medicare more money, so they're not going to want to do that. The provider will be forced to do it because if they accept Medicare, they can't just deny, they can't just say, even though you have Medicare, we're not going to run it through Medicare. That's why they're going to be forced to do it, is they're not allowed to do that.
Gotcha. Okay, but if there's anybody out there who's actually had that happen to them, send us an email. Let us know what you did and how it worked out, and we'll share it with everybody on the show.
Yeah, that sounds good.
All right, next question. I'm not sure if this guy is overthinking or over-worrying or a little bit of both. So maybe we can...
Or maybe neither.
I think you'll agree with me when you hear his concerns.
Okay.
I don't think it's a specific question per se, and our answer could vary. I don't think there's a correct answer to this either. I'm 68 and plan to wait until 70 to collect Social Security because of the increased benefits. So 2 more years waits, folks. Mm-hmm. I'm healthy, and I can meet all of my income needs for now without Social Security or using any of my retirement savings. So good problem to have. As they say, first world problem. Good problem to have. However, I am concerned about the upcoming Social Security revenue shortfall and the potential for means testing Social Security, especially for people who are not yet claiming benefits. My total spending needs are about $13,000 a month, and I get that now through a combination of pension, deferred income, and interest in dividends. My deferred income will go away in 3 years, so my plan has been to use deferred income as a bridge to Social Security and begin claiming at age 70. I retired at 57 and spread out my deferred income, so when I started my fixed pension, I would basically have a flat income throughout my retirement until my RMDs kick in. So while there is no current need for my Social Security, my question is, how likely is it that means testing could apply to me in the future, even though I am already past full retirement age, but not yet claiming my benefits. Do you think it could affect people even beyond age 70? Thank you. Before you answer, because there's no, I don't think there's a right or wrong answer, folks. My personal belief is they do have to, quote unquote, fix Social Security. But if this gentleman who is going to turn 70 and begin claiming in 2 more years feels this current administration, I'm not dogging on the current administration, but they have yet to even hint that they want to tackle what is known as the third rail of politics, Social Security. I think the Trump administration is saying, hey, we got three and a half more years. We're just going to let it sit, let someone else worry about it. And honestly, the next administration will probably say, we'll let the next administration worry about it. It's that administration that's going to have to deal with it and take all the heat. But politicians love to kick the can down the road, and they love to wait to the point where they can say that this is a crisis.
Yeah.
Because then they can pretty much do anything. It's a crisis. We've got to fix this. Hurry, hurry. We didn't see this coming. Everybody else saw this train coming, but the politicians didn't. So they'll wait till it becomes a crisis. So I personally don't think this listener at 68 has to worry. Now, could they go after people who are already claiming? They could do anything they want. They're the ones who created, not them personally, but their forefathers of politicians in the 1930s created this program. They can do whatever they want with it. They could, quote unquote, means test it, but him delaying Social Security or claiming it now isn't going to fix it if they means test Social Security. My personal gut tells me they'll probably change the tax structure a little, maybe remove the cap of how much income is subject to Social Security taxes, and officially make Social Security a social welfare program rather than a social insurance program. I think they will, for younger folk, push out the retirement age. So many European countries are currently doing that, pushing out the retirement age. I feel 67 will be pushed out probably to 68, 69. And maybe you're what is now age 70, maybe for people in their 40s and 50s, they may have to wait to 71. I see them playing with it that way. I don't personally see them coming after people who are currently claiming or could have been currently claiming, but for one reason or another shut it off. I don't see them coming after them. It's not to say they wouldn't, but I just personally don't see it. But for you, listener, just 2 years away, I think you're way overthinking this if you feel this current administration is going to willfully take up the third rail of politics. What do you think, Chris?
Well, I'll reiterate one thing you said. Congress can do anything. So it's anything is possible. Now, just because something is possible, it's also possible to be struck by lightning, but highly unlikely, right? So I think there's things that are likely to happen and things much less likely to happen. Historically, when there's been major changes to Social Security, which have happened numerous times throughout its existence, this is not going to be the first time there's going to be major adjustments to Social Security. It's happened quite a few times. Whenever that's happened, they have grandfathered in people under the current rules, effectively, that were all, you know, of Social Security age, whether they were claiming or not. That wasn't a distinction. I don't think that's going to be a distinction. How fair would that be to someone who was claiming be treated different than someone else, both of the same age? I don't see that. And I think that's one of those very low likelihood of occurring. Everybody the same age, I think, will be treated the same, whether you're claiming or not. So I wouldn't worry too much about that personally. These are all my views. But again, Congress can do anything. Below a certain age, then you'll have to learn to work with the new rules, etc. What I think could happen to everyone of any age, if they do go the means testing route, which we already have a form of means testing, just so y'all know, if you haven't put two and two together, the taxation of Social Security under that graduated format we have is means testing. People with higher incomes, which comes from having more resources in retirement, have more of their Social Security taxed. And when those dollars are taken away, it's effectively a reduction in your Social Security. It's just the way the math works, right? So we already have a bit of a form of means testing. Could they deploy a broader version of means testing? Yes, and I think that's the one where I think that could apply to everyone of every age. It's just kind of the argument that, you know, everyone is going to take a little bit of pain here. And if we decide to go as one of the adjustment levers, means testing, where they reduce benefits if you know, I don't know how they're going to measure your means. there's a lot of different ways to do that. That could happen, and I don't know that you'd be, again, I don't think you'll be protected if you're claimed or not claimed. I think it's going to apply to whoever they decide to apply it to, which could be broadly to everybody. An outright adjustment in the benefit calculation, that's where it's less likely in my mind that if you're over a certain age, and I think if you're over about 60, I think an outright adjustment to your benefit calculation has a low likelihood of happening, part of that kind of grandfathering in technique. If you're in your mid to lower 50s or younger, I think a core adjustment to the benefit calculation absolutely could happen. And then other things that aren't part of the direct calculation, like your full retirement age definition, how delayed retirement credits apply up to a certain age, and some of those other things could be adjusted as well, which aren't a direct change to the core benefit calculation. But I think there's one thing I want to point out. He didn't ask it directly, but something that comes up all the time. I get emails frequently that, gee, if this is going to happen, should that change my Social Security claiming strategy? If they're going to, you know, run out of money, or if they're going to change something. I say no. And the reason is this. Imagine this. You know, here we're facing what, if they don't do anything, 2034-ish, Social Security trustees estimate that the trust fund cushion will be gone at that point, which will then only allow Social Security to pay out about 80%, a little less than 80%, but it's about 80% of promised benefits. So the idea is, if that happens, everybody's going to suddenly take a 20% haircut in their benefits, because there's nothing in the Social Security rules that allow the administration to favor one beneficiary over another. So I think there'd be just a flat across the board 20% reduction for everybody if Congress sits on their hands and does nothing. So with that looming in the future, I get asked, should I change my strategy? I know I thought I was going to do this, but I'm not. But, you know, should this change? Should I claim earlier or later? In my book, it doesn't really matter. You know, that's not a variable to consider. And the reason I say that is the size of your benefit at face value does not really determine your strategy. For example, if you have two neighbors that live right next to one another, and one neighbor has a 20% lower benefit than the other neighbor, does the neighbor with the lower benefit have a different optimal age of claiming? No. Everything is scaled based on your base retirement benefit. You know, the increase for waiting, the decrease for filing early, it's all a proportion of your core benefit. And just because someone has a bigger benefit than another person doesn't inherently change the strategy. And that's what we're looking at here. I think of you before and after 2034 as two different people. Just because your benefit's 20% less, did that claim when you should have started collecting benefits? I say no. Now there could be a slight argument for, let me get it out before the reduction happens. So let me be paid my full amount for a while before the 20% haircut. Now, though, you are making a decision to guarantee less income in the long run, because you're claiming earlier than you otherwise would, on the chance it might be reduced in 2034. And I don't like those odds, personally. I don't like taking something that could happen and making it happen for sure down the road, right? So if there was evidence that you would benefit from the longevity protection that a higher Social Security benefit would bring you, and I would argue if there's a 20% reduction and you're looking for more lifetime long-term income, you want to get your benefit as big as humanly possible before the 20% cut, which is going to happen by delaying. So just consider that. Don't see this as, gee, these changes might happen, so I'm gonna pull the trigger early, even though I was previously convinced I should wait. Let me do it early because of all this. I think that's not a good way of looking at it personally. I guess I could see someone come up with a mathematical calculation that might make an argument the other way. But I think if you're looking at Social Security the way we do, which is the benefits in the long run, if you live long time and your assets are stressed, having the income that lasts forever coming in and wanting that to be stout, robust, and you do that by waiting to claim. If you're viewing Social Security as a benefit in that regard, I think you'll stick to your strategy. If you're trying to play some kind of break-even game, something like that, playing the odds, then certainly you can make any argument you want, because then it depends on your assumed mortality age and things like that. I'd be really careful with that type of analysis, as popular as that might be. I think break-even analysis is one of the worst ways to decide when to take Social Security. I think you're devaluing its true gloriousness, which is in long-term lifetime income that will be there if you live longer than average. If you live shorter than average, you probably have enough assets to not worry about it. But if you live longer than average, that's where Social Security being as large as possible is really going to pay off. So that was my opining on the whole thing. Probably went a little beyond what you wanted, but there you go.
Wow, that was a long one.
Yeah, sorry.
See, I told you, new listeners, he's the one that goes on and on and on. I am the pithy one. Okay, let's get to the annuity question of the week. This is kind of a double potter. Easy questions. Long, but easy. My answer will be a lot shorter than what Chris just did. Okay, my trivia question is at the end of this email. All right, hold on. Let me scroll down to the end of the email. Here's my trivia question. Oh, he lives in two states. He has a summer and winter home. So this is a two-bagger for you. Mm-hmm. Mark Twain was born in this state. Hint, the city name is also a state name that I also live in. So he was born He was born in a city, in a state, and the city had a state name.
That he now lives
and
in.
And the state name is also a state he lives in, plus the state Mark Twain was born in, he lives in.
Wow.
Wow, how did he figure that out?
That's an interesting one. Wasn't Mark Twain born in Tennessee?
I'm not saying anything. You just...
You're not helpful.
Well, no, I'm not going to be helpful. You had help. It was called ChatGPT, and it was voted out. It was voted off the island.
So do I have to guess two different states?
Nope, just one state.
I'm going to go with Tennessee.
Mark Twain was born in Florida, Missouri.
Missouri.
And he spends his time between Missouri and Florida.
Interesting.
Yes. Okay, here's this question. I'll be 68 this month. There are some annuities and aspects of annuities that I really like. But if I buy one inside of an IRA now at age 68, and it has a penalty period that's going to last for more than 5 years, then my required minimum distributions will begin during the surrender period. As I understand it, the required minimum distribution still has to be paid to the IRS. But now the insurance company will apply a penalty on my withdrawal. Am I looking at this correctly? Seems like using IRA money to buy an annuity at this point could be a bad idea. Well, listener, you are correct and wrong at the same. Well, I wouldn't say wrong, but nearly every single annuity that I have ever seen will waive the penalty on RMDs. And they do it one of two ways. They'll just outward say, hey, if you're RMD age and you have to take an RMD, we are not going to impose a penalty. or they give you a free withdrawal amount. It varies between 5 and 10% per year. The one that I see most often is 10, but I've recently seen one for 7, and 5% is also quite common. Your initial RMD is about 3.7%. So most of the free withdrawals will also cover the penalty if you need to cover your required minimum distribution. So I don't think that's going to be an issue if you want to buy an annuity inside an IRA. I'm assuming you're talking about buying a deferred annuity, not necessarily a deferred income annuity. The deferred income annuity, folks, is the verb. You've given up your money, and in return, you are going to get a lifetime stream of guaranteed income at some point in the future. Now, technically speaking, by a definition, it means 13 or more months into the future. Could be 13 years into the future, could be 10 years into the future, 5 years, or 13 months into the future. That's called a deferred income annuity. If you are going to begin the income within 1 month of buying it or 12 months later, which is technically the 13th month, that is called a single premium immediate annuity. Even though you may not begin income for 8, 10, 12 months, they still call that immediate. I'm guessing, listener, you're talking about buying a deferred income, just a deferred annuity, the noun. You're just looking for an annuity that maybe the RILA that we spoke about last week. I'm just guessing. I'm just coming up with thoughts. Maybe you're looking at the RILA because you like the degree of principal protection, higher cap rate than you might get on a buffered ETF, and you're fine with locking your money up for the penalty period, which you concede might be more than 5 years. I'm just guessing what type of annuity, because you didn't give me a specific type of annuity, but I'm guessing, folks, he's talking about buying the noun annuity, not the verb annuity. Because first of all, if he was to try to buy a deferred income annuity inside an IRA, he would have to do one of two things: defer the income no longer than his RMD age, which for him would be 5 years from now, or buy a QLAC, Chris's favorite annuity. And he never mentioned QLAC. So I don't think he's buying a deferred income annuity. The QLAC would have solved his issue, folks, because QLACs don't have to begin payments until you're 85. A QLAC is a deferred income annuity. It's a verb, but it's designed specifically to be held in an IRA and not worry about RMDs until you reach 85, not 73. And soon for Chris and I, it'll be 75 for us. So if he was to buy a deferred annuity, the noun, no lifetime stream of guaranteed income, just a deferred annuity, and he likes the growth potential of the deferred annuity for one reason or another. If he buys just a deferred annuity and he has to debit that IRA annuity for his RMD, he has no other IRA out there that he could take the money from, because as Chris will agree, if he had two IRAs, he could take it from the other one. Correct, Chris?
Yeah, since you're considered to have just one IRA, even though you think you have two or more, they're considered one, and you can satisfy the RMDs from any combination of contributions from your various IRAs.
Correct. So if he's buying just a deferred annuity, it's not been annuitized, it's not the verb, it's not giving him a lifetime stream of guaranteed income at some point in the future. If he's just buying a deferred annuity, he can satisfy the RMD from another IRA if he has one. If he doesn't have one and he has to take, or there's not enough money in the other one to satisfy the RMD from the annuity, chances are the insurance company will waive any penalty on the RMD, either outright just by saying, hey, we will never penalize an RMD, or giving you an annual free withdrawal greater than the RMD amount? Okay, that's his first question. Mm-hmm. His second question. I am close to being a unicorn. What's a unicorn, Chris? In our definition, what's a unicorn?
So our definition is someone who has enough secure income to cover not just their minimum dignity floor expenses, but both their minimum dignity floor expenses and all their anticipated fun or desired expenses as well. Because they are fairly rare in our society.
We call them unicorns.
We call them unicorns.
Right. Okay. I am close to being a unicorn. I have pensions, and my wife and I both draw social securities. All of these, including my pensions, have inflation adjustments. I admit this is a great situation for me to be in, except, of course, on April 15th. Mm-hmm. We easily live and have plenty of fun spending, all from our guaranteed lifetime income. Honestly, I don't spend nearly enough on fun. It's a behavioral problem, and I acknowledge that. I guess I'm a better accumulator than spender. Let's pause there. Chris, have we never seen that before?
Well, I'll just say that a lot of times the reason why you've accumulated so much in your life is because you're not a natural or aggressive spender. One of the best techniques for accumulating is to just spend a lot less than your income capacity might otherwise suggest. So it's not surprising. It's actually quite common that we see people that have accumulated noticeable amounts have trouble spending it, even when they recognize they have a substantial amount.
Especially you VGers. You've spent your entire lives. You geek out on this. You're probably all on that Bogglehead forum at Vanguard.com. You're participating in it. Many of you are in the Rock Retirement Club or other clubs. And you guys just geek out on this. And you love growing your assets. And you're loath to spend them. And you could set yourself up to be what my dad, before he died, warned or asked me to warn you guys about. And that's a Debbie Downer. What's, in my dad's definition, a Debbie Downer, Chris?
Well, someone who has reached the point in their life where they still have money to spend, but they're not physically or mentally, health-wise in some regard, able to spend it. So they now have all these regrets that they could have done more, experienced more, whatever, with their money, because now they have the money, but can't do anything with it.
My dad called them Debbie Downer, and Debbie Downers, plural, in his retirement community. And he said the people, you know, before he passed and when he was in the retirement community, before he went into the nursing home, he played bingo and password and just did stuff in this little community room that they had. And he would share with me that when the Debbie Downers walked in, everybody was like, oh, God, they're going to come to our table. And he really said they just were miserable to be around. And the guiding factor of a Debbie Downer, he said, was they have money, but they can't spend it. Okay, it's a behavioral problem, and I acknowledge I'm a better accumulator than spender. Now, I know you and Chris generally advise not to annuitize until you need to, and I don't need to. But if I had an annuity and I turn on the living benefit this year, it's not going to be much. It'll be about $32,000 a year. But my thinking is that having this, and he called it mailbox money, folks. I got news for this listener. They don't mail you a check anymore. So you're not going to be getting a check in the mail. They're going to, you might want to call it electronic deposit money. They're going to electronically deposit. But here's his train of thought, Chris. My thought is having this mailbox money rolling in every month will be good at forcing function to help me spend it on fun. Any thoughts on this? Absolutely, listener. Chris and I have said repeatedly, we like covering minimum dignity floor with lifetime guaranteed secure income for many reasons. We generally don't recommend it on fun, except in a situation like you're describing. Perhaps to us, to Chris and I, and if you're listening to us and you like our approach to retirement planning and you're trying to model it yourself, you may also recognize a big risk isn't outliving your money. Most of the people listening to this podcast will have several million of assets. We talk all the time, probably at about 2.8 million is just some random number we chose. But the more we get emails from people, it seems to be fairly close and accurate. But our point is, most of you VG do-it-yourselfers, and if you're still young in your 30s and 40s and early 50s and listening, and you don't have that much in wealth, or you have substantially more, but if you don't have that much, give it time. You will amass enough wealth. If you're listening to this podcast and managing your own assets and controlling what you spend in fees into Wall Street, you will be able to amass wealth. But if you're having trouble spending it, one of the things we like about covering minimum dignity floor with lifetime stream of guaranteed income and not through withdrawals from your assets, even if you have enough in assets to cover your minimum dignity floor shortage or the portion of your minimum dignity floor not covered by Social Security, pension, and any annuities that you may already have turned on for income. One of the reasons we like covering it with annuity income and not withdrawals is the simplicity factor. The fact that as you age, your ability to understand financial concepts will begin to diminish, and or we hope you're out spending on fun and not sitting around wondering what the Wall Street is doing, the economy is doing, politicians are doing, your portfolio is doing. You're just out having fun. And knowing that this steady paycheck comes in every month electronically right into your bank account from a pension, from Social Security, from an annuity, and your food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses, maybe also on auto payment, and they're all being covered, is very easy. Well, there's another element, and I shared often, I said emotionally, annuities can also help you feel comfortable spending. And I use the analogy of a bottomless cup of coffee. If you're at a cafe, and you're at a cafe with the bottomless cup of coffee rule, you're going to suck your coffee down as fast as you want. You'll share it with the neighbor, spill some, who cares, I can get more. You just have it coming in, so you're going to be more inclined to drink it. But if you're at a cafe that's going to charge you every time you fill your cup of coffee, you may not be so willing to drink it and drink it so openly and quickly. Well, the same concept carries over to income. This gentleman is having a hard time spending an asset, but he has an annuity. The annuity has a living benefit. We're going to cover living benefits on a future EDU show because I didn't get to them during National Annuity Awareness Month in June. But he has a living benefit. So it's a benefit that's going to allow him, folks, to get a lifetime stream of guaranteed income while maintaining his annuity as a noun, not a verb. And he's saying, hey, I never thought I would turn this on, because you don't have to. There's no forcing by the insurance company to turn the living benefit on. In fact, they prefer you not to. And we'll talk about that during my deep dive into living benefits. But he's sitting there thinking, gosh, I can get $32,000. I don't need it. But maybe if this $32,000 is coming to me every year, I'm going to spend it. And since I don't need it for my minimum dignity floor, it'll force me to spend it on fun. I like the idea, listener. I truly do. And I don't like the idea of holding living benefit riders and not turning them on. Because when you actually figure out what you're paying the insurance company for that living benefit rider, it's going to shock you. And you're probably going to be more inclined to want to turn the damn thing on. So if they're going to give you $32,000 a year for the rest of your life, you didn't tell us if it was joint and survivor or not, I doubt it has any type of inflationary adjustment built into it, nor will it ever get one, even though they're often marketed as having the ability to get a pay raise. Trust me, you're probably never going to get one. So he's going to get $32,000 a year level income for the rest of his life. I love it if it's going to help him spend it on fun so he's not a Debbie Downer. What say you, Chris?
Yeah, I think this is a clear example where the numbers and the finances might not imply using a particular tool like this annuity if it helps you overcome what you've, with self-awareness, realized is a personality emotional issue. Instead, I'm all for it as well. I really like it because I think that's absolutely true. When you've got, you know, I don't drink as much coffee, but if I'm having a soda or something at a restaurant, if it's free refills, I drink it as fast as I want to. Sometimes I'm not that thirsty. I don't even make it through the first one, but other times I'll drink three. You know, it kind of depends on my mood and how the day is and all that and how long I've been sitting there, things like that. So I don't think about it. If I have to pay for each one, then I'm a lot more careful. You know, it's still, you know, it's then I'm in that scarcity mode instead, which a lot of accumulators are in that scarcity mindset constantly, which is why they've saved so much. So if you realize that's an issue for you and feel that this is something that, you know, could help you with that, I'm all for it. I'm all for it. I think it sounds great.
All righty, we got two questions that are very, 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 very similar. So I'm going to try to kill two birds with one stone. What do you think these two questions are about? It's been... 6 weeks since we had one.
Please, Roth 5-year rule.
5-year rule. I don't know. This thing refuses to die, Chris. It truly does. All right. We'll begin with our state hint.
Let me say before you read this, this is clearly an indication that Congress should simplify these rules. If this is constantly causing confusion, imagine how many people are messing this up. Because we only hear about the ones who are reaching out because they know they're confused. There's a whole bunch of people out there who think they have it figured out and are totally wrong.
Yeah.
And doing inappropriate things. So I think this requires congressional action.
Yeah, good luck trying to get Congress to fix the tax code. Anyway. They just screwed it up with 1,000 more pages of crap. Yeah. So don't think that they're going to start trying to simplify this. Have you seen – I know you did a show on the Big Beautiful Bill. My God, I've been attending a few seminars and reading. They've just complicated the tax code 10 times over.
Even more.
Yeah. Oh, my God. What the hell were they smoking? This Colorado pot crap, I think, has got all the way into Washington. All right. State hint first. Uh-huh. The name of my state is said to come from a 16th century, that's the 1500s for those of you at home, Spanish novel which describes an island populated by women dressed only in gold armor. I'm trying to find that island, by the way. The name of the state is also said to mean hot furnace. In Latin.
What? An island with... those aren't the Amazons. Those are the... What are they? I don't know. Hot furnace. What is... Arizona?
California. You have to Google it. I Googled it and got the whole explanation. I was trying to find this island. Interesting. I am single, folks. So an island full of women dressed in gold armor? Yeah, I'm there. All right. Hi, Jim and Chris. I'm on the losing end in my office on this debate regarding Roth conversions. Mm-hmm. One side says, after the age 59 and a half, if a Roth has been open for 5 years, all distributions will be qualified and not subject to tax or penalty. In other words, one no longer has to track their conversion separately. The other side in the office says...
He's wrong.
Let me finish. The other side in the office says, although Roth conversions are not subject to the 10% penalty after 59 and a half, they are still subject to taxes on earnings on those conversions if those conversions have not been held in the account for 5 years. Do you have the it sound?
I do.
But anyways, let me...
That's for the second group.
That's for the second group. Here's the rest of her email. I thought I heard on your show one of the above answers, but my office and a CPA and all the online opinions that I don't know what online opinions she's getting, favor the first over the second.
Well, that's true. The first thing you read was correct.
Oh, excuse me. And all the online opinions favor the second. What say you? I'm sorry, not the first over the second. She favors the first.
She's right.
Everyone's going with the second. Mm. So let's go through this one last time, folks.
It's not going to be the last time.
Yeah, true. I say that all the time. The first group is correct in her example. There are 2 5-year rules. Let's start with the second, which seems to confuse the hell out of everyone. The 5-year rule on conversions, which says your converted amount must sit there for 5 years, or if you take it out, you will pay a 10% penalty. If you just stop and think, why did Congress pass that second rule? You'll understand why at 59 and a half it goes away. Congress wanted to keep people, because money you put into a Roth IRA, whether it is from a contribution or a conversion, is after-tax dollars. The conversion is taxed. Contributions are after-tax. So they can be removed technically at any time for any reason, no taxes, no penalties. But Congress said, wait a minute. If we allow conversions to also be removed at any time for any reason, no taxes, no penalties, people younger than 59 and a half, rather than taking money out of their IRA to go buy a couch or a bike or a vacation, use it for something other than their retirement, would simply convert the dollars first to a Roth, then withdraw them, and be absolved from the 10% early withdrawal penalty. Well, we can't have that. So they said, if you do a conversion and withdraw those converted dollars within the first 5 years of converting, you will pay a 10% penalty. But Congress also said this rule, this second rule, goes away at 59 and a half.
Right, which is when the 10% penalty would naturally go away anyway. So the second rule, keep in your mind, is only about the 10% penalty. The 10% penalty is distinct and separate from the definition of a qualified distribution. The qualified distribution, which is, I'm sure, what Jim's going to talk about next, is what determines if a distribution is taxable, not a penalty, taxable. And that has nothing to do with whether the dollars are converted or contributed. So the second rule, the conversions, the only rule that involves conversions as a restriction, as a tax slash penalty, is the second rule. And it's all about the penalty, not about the taxability of the distribution.
Perfect. So the first 5-year rule also doesn't apply in that first example that she gave, the first description. I'm trying to find it here.
Because it's met both prongs of the 2-prong test.
Correct. So to absolve yourself from the first 5-year rule, which has to do with getting your earnings out.
Right.
And remember, this is a layer cake when you take money out of a Roth. Contributions come out first, tax and penalty free at any time. Conversions come out next.
Tax free.
Tax free, because maybe, you already paid taxes, right, maybe penalty free. Yeah, if you're over 59 and a half, definitely penalty free.
Or
if you're under 59 and a half, as long as they've been in there for 5 years. And each conversion has its own layer. Yep. So you could literally track each conversion every year. And once it's been in there for 5 years, those converted dollars can come out penalty free, even if you're younger than 59 and a half, because they've been in there for 5 years. And when you're over 59 and a half, which in her example they were, no problem there either. So what about growth? Growth is the last thing to ever come out of a Roth IRA. You have to burn through contributions. You have to burn through conversions. Then you get growth. In order to get growth out, that's what we call, or Congress called, a qualified withdrawal. What's it qualify for, Chris?
Tax-free treatment.
Tax-free treatment. So Congress says there's a two-prong test. First, Roth IRA must be 5 years old. That's a simple one. And in her example, she said the Roth is 5 years old.
Yep.
Second prong, you have to be over 59 and a half. Dead doesn't help you. But in other words, your beneficiaries can take it out, even if they're younger than 59 and a half tax-free. So you, the IRA owner, have to be over 59 and a half. You have to be dead. You have to be disabled. Or you have to be buying a first-time home, at which point you can take $10,000 of growth out tax-free.
Right.
So that's the two-prong test.
And you notice that nowhere in that description did it mention anything about conversions.
Exactly. Okay, that's the first one. Hopefully, it's cleared up the office hubbub. Here's the second five-year rule. Here's his hint. State hint. I suspect this is going to take Chris a moment or two, but I also suspect he will correctly guess through the process of elimination. He's put the pressure on you for sure. A 2013 black and white film follows the journey of a Montana man as he drives south to claim a sweepstakes prize. The film is named after my state, but my state is not Montana.
A 2013 black and white film where he drives from Montana to claim... Wow. I have no idea. He drives south. So let's go with New Mexico.
Nebraska.
I have no idea what that one was.
I never saw the film. Obviously, you didn't.
Did he state
either.
The film? Did he say what it was?
Well, the film is named after the state he lives in.
Named Nebraska?
Yeah, so there's some film out there called Nebraska.
Interesting. Not heard of it.
Yeah, I heard, isn't there a Bruce Springsteen song, Nebraska?
I'm sorry I let him down. He was confident I'd figure it out. I missed the mark. Although my answer also begins with N.
Yes, New Mexico. Mm-hmm. All right.
Which is a state in our union, just for those of you out there who thinks it's a foreign country.
Okay, I'm going to let you answer this one only. Well, okay. Actually, I can answer this one if you are not quite sure.
Okay.
But he references you in the question. My question, I believe Chris mentioned during his discussion about the five-year seasoning, as he calls it, of Roth accounts, that no matter when in the calendar year you make a first-time contribution to open a Roth, it will be considered opened on January 1st of that year.
Yeah.
I believe Chris also mentioned that the fifth year actually is considered completed on January 1st of the fifth year. You don't have to wait till December 31st of that fifth year. So if I heard correctly, here's my thoughts. I opened a Roth in May of 2021. Therefore, year one began on January 1st of 2021. Year five would be 2025. Mm-hmm. But if I understood Chris, it would be considered completed this past January 1st of 2025, and I do not have to wait to December 31st of 2025. I want to directly transfer this Roth in its entirety to my Vanguard Roth, but I need to wait until December 31st. I don't want to lose the seasoning. It has accrued in the, he's talking about moving a TSP, I'm sorry, accrued in the TSP. Can I execute this transfer now versus waiting and having the funds retain their seasoning to satisfy the five-year rule? By the way, I'm over 59 and a half. Thanks for your podcast. I listen while walking or jogging in the morning. Mm-hmm.
So I know the first part, you might call out the second part. So the first part, his interpretation is exactly correct. Basically, to meet the five-year rule, the Roth has to be in existence in any day of the year. And so you technically can satisfy the five-year rule in as little as 3 years and 2 days, if I did my math right. So whenever during the year you make your first contribution, you get credit for a full year, that first year. So in his math, his 5 years on the calendar clock, he'd have to wait till May, when in fact, when he hit January 1st of 2025, he was 5 years on there. So he can move it no matter what. However, the one thing, I don't think he asked it directly, but I'd be curious about if he'd only satisfied like 4 years worth, doesn't he get credit if he moves it out to the Vanguard? Wouldn't 4 years of the 5 years of seasoning still stick with it? He's not like he's going to lose it and have to start over again. It's not like it has to be fully 5 years seasoned to retain it. It would retain any portion of the 5 years that had been earned up to the point of transferring it to the IRA.
Before you go further, the way that I've always remembered this, and I mentioned it on the show, because listen, you're wrong. You have to wait to January of 2026. The easiest way to remember how to do this, and I confirmed this with the Ed Slot Group because it's been, I just wanted to make sure. But the way I mentally remember it, it's the way that Ed first described it once, is he made his first contribution in May of 2021. So Ed said, you're standing on a rock with 2021 on it. Mm-hmm. And he said, in front of you are a series of other rocks, 22, 23, 24, 25, so on and so forth. He says, take 5 steps. So 21 becomes 22, 23, 24, 25, 26. January 1st of 2026, his Roth will be 5 years old. So I got a hold of the Ed Slot Group and just wanted to make sure. And here's their answer. Yes, a Roth account open mid-year will get a January 1st start date. In your example, a person who opened their account in May of 2021. This results in a January of 2021 start date. 5 years from that start date is January 1st, 2026.
Yeah, I counted it wrong. So it was, but it's January. So he doesn't have to wait till May. So he gets benefit of the full year. And he only has to wait until January of when he steps onto that fifth rock. So yes, I when they said January of 2025, I was counting on my fingers and I did it wrong.
So if he had put the money in December 31st, 2021, and he only has to go to January 1st of 2026, technically speaking, in between there, folks, is all of 2022, 23, 24, and 25.
So it's 4 years and 2 days. If you happen to do your first contribution as late as December 31st of the year, you get full credit for that 1 year. But thereafter, you have to count off 5 steps.
So just again, listeners, just do the that's how I've always remembered this. When Ed gave that visual, I always picture a rock and I'm standing on that rock and the year of contribution is on that rock. I've got to take 5 steps.
Yeah. So what about my kind of extension question that he didn't ask? If he doesn't make it, and we talk about how someone has, say, a Roth TSP or a Roth 401k, but never had a Roth IRA, that as long as the dollars had reached the 5-year seasoning in the 401k, they retain the seasoning when they come out. But what if they didn't quite make it? What if he pulled the trigger too soon and it only had 4 years of seasoning? Does he have to start over, or does he have to just go another year?
No, he's got to now start over because they did not move qualified.
Yeah, that's...
They were not seasoned.
It's that, yeah. So I'm glad you clarified that, because that was the part that I was confused or just hadn't quite figured out, that I figured there'd be. And I think now that you mentioned, I think we have talked about that before, but that's an important thing to remember. Got to get those seasoned. Now, if you have a 5-year old IRA already, or maybe it's 4 years old or something that is already out there, you don't have to worry about these new dollars coming out and having to start over for 5 years, right? They're gonna get the seasoning that the IRA already retained. They just aren't gonna have their full seasoning qualified status unless you get them to the full 5 years in the 401k. If in fact you're bringing it out to what for most people might be a brand new IRA, they're opening up to put the money in from the TSP or the IRA or the 401k. So you'd hate to miss it by just a little bit if you needed to access those dollars, right? If you needed to, now remember, it's only the earnings that are going to be of concern here, and you're going to burn through any contributions, conversions first, so it might be a moot point. It might not be that big a deal. If you're not going to burn through the contributions in, 5 years, then you'll never make it to the earnings, and you don't have to worry about it, and by that time, the IRA will be fully seasoned for a qualified withdrawal. So,
and we've said this repeatedly, folks. Now, he's over 59 and a half, as he pointed out. But let's say he's under 59 and a half, and he waits till January 1st of 2026. Now his TSP is fully seasoned. And let's pretend he doesn't have a Roth. And let's just say, I don't know how much he can get into his TSP, but let's just say there's $100,000 of contributions and growth in that TSP. But it is now... Well, actually, no, it's not seasoned because he has to be over 59 and a half. I apologize. So in my example, he is 59 and a half or older. So now he has it seasoned. What do we mean? Well, Chris calls it seasoned. It's not a IRC code or a code from a verbiage from Congress. That's right. Chris. Well, what Chris is essentially saying is the two-prong test has been satisfied. The guy is over 59 and a half, prong one. Prong two, the Roth is at least 5 years old, or the guy is dead, which he's not, or disabled, which he's not, or buying a first-time home, which he's not. But the second prong, he's satisfied with the 5 years. January 1st, 2026, his TSP will be 5 years old, and he's over 59 and a half. So he has a seasoned Roth, in my hypothetical example, of $100,000. Let's just say it's $50,000 a contribution and $50,000 a growth. He bought some wonderful investments inside his TSP, and he has $50,000 of contributions, $50,000 a growth. It's all seasoned, but he has no Roth IRA in my hypothetical. But now he moves it because it's seasoned. So now he moves it to a brandy new Roth. He can take out that $100,000 at any time. Because it's seasoned. It doesn't lose its seasoning, if you will. However, let's just say he moves that $100,000 Roth into a brandy new Roth, invests it, and 3 years from now, it's worth $130,000. Guy's a great investor. So he's now got $130,000, and he wants all of it. He wants to buy something. He will owe taxes on that $30,000 because his Roth is not 5 years old yet. It's only three. Right. However, because he moved the $100,000 in my example and it was fully seasoned, over that $100,000 does not lose its seasoning.
Right.
But the growth has to stay in for two more years to be able to get it out. He can get $100,000 out. And he can choose that first.
He doesn't choose it. It gets forced upon him
first. Yes. But if he takes the 30 of growth, he owes taxes on it.
Right.
Now, if he didn't season, he didn't wait to January 1st of 2026. He moved it December 31st, 2025. Now, in my example, he has 50,000 of contributions, 50,000 of unseasoned growth, and 30,000 of additional growth. Now, 80,000 has to sit inside that Roth until it's 5 years old, right, or he will owe taxes on it.
But the original 50 of contributions from the 401k, the original source, it retains its character. It's not really seasoned. It just never was subject to taxes and penalties in the first place.
Correct. All righty, folks. Well, that is, I think, going to wrap it up. I wanted to get to one more question, but it's going to take me a while to explain, and it'll go too long. But it's a good one, and I'll try to get to it next week. But it had to do with an inherited IRA and the titling of the inherited IRA and how much of an RMD needs to be taken, because it's confusing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, a perfect stopping spot. I want to thank everybody for listening, and thank you for sending in questions. If you want to send in your own questions, send them to Jim directly. Jim@jimhelps.com is the email address. That's jim@jimhelps.com. Put in the subject line, it's a question for the podcast, and include a word or two about the subject matter. That's always helpful. And yeah, that's about it. Jim, you have a nice weekend, and everybody else, stay healthy and safe, and hope your summer is not too hot, just right. And we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jimhelps.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.